Okay, well, good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And we're very honored to be launching J.A. Jantz, our good friend's brand new book, Unfinished Business, The Return of Allie Reynolds. And Judy has been kind enough to sign a whole bunch of them in her customary red. So during the conversation, I'll put a link in the comments field if you'd like to order one of the signed copies. They are going fast, as always. And I'll be monitoring the comments field. So if you have questions for Judy or Barbara, go ahead and put them in, and I'll reemerge from the darkness when Barbara summons me at the end of the program. And Barbara, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Patrick. It is a pleasure, J.A. Jantz, to welcome you back. And I have an appropriate Sedona Red little drink here to toast you on your publication day.
Another opening, another show, from Billy Boston to Baltimore. Another chance, folks, to say hello. Another opening, another show.
Very good. Well, and there we are. So this has been fun because I've gotten to talk to you twice in just a few months. Last time I was saying, I'm going to call her Judy. I know it's J.A. Jantz, but I just can't do J.A. It sounds ridiculous.
That's fine.
She is in tasteful Bisbee blue in order to match the cover because yes. Allie Reynolds is an Arizona book. But in truth, she's really up north rather than Joanna Brady down in Cochise County. We're up in Sedona. So I am wearing Sedona.
As far as I know, there's no such thing as Jerome turquoise, but I'm sure there. I don't know what the color is. I'm sure there was turquoise high graded out of the mines in Jerome as well, but Bisbee Blue is a name brand of turquoise.
Absolutely, and I wore mine when we did this before. Thank and they you. Really are a greenish, they're a beautiful color and they're more, excuse me, they are more green than they are blue, but I'm a big fan of the Red Rock Country and I love Sedona Red. Is there a Jerome Red? I never even thought about Jerome as a red.
Not as far as I know, but maybe there is. I'm going to have to consult with my a geology professor and find out.
Excellent idea. And if you've never been to the Red Rocks in northern Arizona, they are truly fabulous. I'm sorry. Let me do that again. When I had my cataract surgery 10 years ago, and you don't really realize until you've had cataract surgery how blurry and how shaded your vision is. And I had one eye off, they do them one at a time. So I had a patch over one eye and the other eye had been done. And we went up to Cottonwood and we took the train, the little old train that they have made a tourist train. And it goes up into the Red Rock Country, up into Sedona, and it's magnificent. And there I was, Judy, it was amazing. I mean, I had one eye that could really see it and one eye where it was all kind of sandy and horrible. And I thought, what a miracle it is, you know, to have vision and to be able to see those gorgeous colors.
Well, I haven't had my cataract surgery yet. I'm sure it's coming. But I was driving my husband home from his, and I'm driving, and he's looking out the window and he said, well, all those people on the sidewalk have faces. And I thought, how long have I been riding around in the car driven by Mr. Magoo?
Boy, that is a horrible thought. I was just a lack of color. But and you know, there was a book written up in the Wall Street Journal today about how evolution has given us sort of non-functional bodies or bodies doomed to all kinds of problems. And one of the things they pointed out was that we don't have as many eye receptors as many animals. And we can't see ultraviolet particularly well. And that gives like the common gecko a huge advantage over us because they can see like 100 million times better with better color than we can. And so cataract surgery is just like a minor version of illustrating all this. So before we get into the book, the other thing we're going to talk about briefly is bowling, because this book is dedicated by J.A. Jantz. Well, you tell it. It's your story. It's a great story.
It's dedicated to CSJ, Colt Stephen Jantz, my grandson, and Michael S. Colt is 15. Michael just turned 21. And they've been bowling buddies for years. And during the pandemic, the only bowling alley in the state that was still open was at a casino. So Michael would pick Colt up and take him to the casino for bowling after he got out of virtual school. But bowling alleys are more or less open again. And so that's to CSJ and Michael S. bowl on. But those kids have been bowling together for years. And when I started out as a bowling, I actually met Michael's bowling grandma at a book signing in Sun City. And she said, oh, my grandson Michael bowls with your grandson. But when I started out, I knew nothing about bowling. The first tournament I went to with Colt, he was just a little kid and he had just barely started. So he had a huge handicap. It was Christmas vacation and Colt was out of school, but his mom was working. And she said, Mom, would you please take Colt to this tournament? It'll be over by 4. So I said, okay. So I took him there and I didn't know how to sign him in, and I didn't know how to do the brackets, and I didn't know how to keep score. So the other parents were sort of helping me keep score. Well, he made the first cut. He made the second cut. Now, the complicating factor on this day was it was our anniversary. And my husband and I had a reservation to go to a very nice restaurant. And I had been told it would be over at 4 o'clock. But he kept making the cut. And I said to the parents, what happens now? They said, more bowling. Well, he ended up winning that tournament because of his handicap. He came in at a 289, the highest score he's ever gotten in a tournament. And I went to dinner at the nice restaurant in my bowling grandma attire. But it was a big learning curve for me to learn how to keep score and I had never realized that there were oil patterns in bowling alleys and in tournaments especially. And so when people encounter the oil patterns in this book, they'll know that that's thanks to my grandson.
I think that's a wonderful story. I grew up bowling. The Winnetka Community House had all kinds of junior leagues. So I bowled through eighth grade, and that was before automatic pin setters. And it was actually a decent job for kids to become pin setters. It was slightly dangerous if you got a guy who could really throw that ball down there and blitz all the pins for a strike. I guess you could get hurt a little bit, but the other thing that was great about it was that it was an equal sport for boys and girls, because it doesn't take that much physical strength to be a great bowler. It takes coordination and a good eye, and you have to slide forward on your foot in the whole bit. And it's great if you have your own bowling ball, but I love the fact that it was equal and that the girls could actually beat the boys.
What I found in going to bowling tournaments is that there are all ethnicities, all races, and they're all there together. The kids are down on the lanes. The parents, who are always the problem at kids' sports, aren't allowed down on the lanes on the approach.
Right.
And those kids are all down there being good sports and cheering one another on and mm-hmm. congratulating one when they hit a good shot. And what I really appreciate about learning about bowling is the camaraderie and the good sportsmanship.
Well, it is. But the other good thing about bowling, like golf, is basically you're bowling against yourself. You know, it's not a team sport. It may be that the scores align, but basically when you bowl, you're bowling and, you know, you're your own competition.
The other issue for Colt is his father died at age 36 after a 9-year battle with malignant melanoma. And my daughter wanted him to get into a sport that didn't require sunscreen. And believe me, bowling is it.
Excellent point. Right. And besides, you have to be a bowling grandma. What better, better than that? Well, anyway, now you know about the dedication of this excellent book, Unfinished Business. And I might add that I lost count when we did this in March for February.
I counted two. It's 60.
Thank you.
Book number 60.
60 books.
And the book I finished writing a book yesterday morning, the next Beaumont book, and that's number 61. So I continue to be fully employed.
You do. That's really impressive. And that's across the J.P. Beaumont series, the Joanna Brady series, the Allie Reynolds series, the Walker Family series, a book of poetry, and the odd novella here and there. So I love the fact that Judy has created these whole casts of characters, these ensemble groups for different series, and how invested you can get in them. And this particular book, I think, has, at least this is my analysis, it has really three story tracks. And it's not so much, it's not really about who done it, it's about what will happen. And you get to trace these stories across. And I fell really in love with Mateo, who, while this may be an Allie Reynolds book, I think Mateo is the character that really drives the whole thing.
And Mateo is the one that walks away with this book. I spent 5 years as a K through 12 librarian on the Tohono O'odham Reservation. And I did a lot of storytelling there. And I learned from the storytellers on the reservation. And one of the things they taught me is that a story must end where it begins. And that's why this book starts in the Washington Reformatory at Monroe. And that's also where it ends.
It is indeed. In fact, I was going to ask you, have you been inside? I mean, you really know a lot about prisons. No, I was impressed.
No, the only jail I've ever been inside was the jail in Chehalis. Yeah. I wrote a book where Bo ends up running afoul of a bad guy in Lewis County, and the bad guy turns out to be a Lewis County cop, a deputy. So this is an early Beaumont book. So, and don't ask me what number, I don't remember. But a couple of years later, I'm at home, I'm writing, it's the middle of the afternoon and the phone rings and I said, hello. And this guy said, is this J.A. Jantz? And I said, yes. He said, I'm Bill Logan, do you know me? No. He said, well, I'm the sheriff of Lewis County. How did you know I had a bad deputy?
Wow, an inside squeal from the sheriff's department. Huh?
I had made that up, and I assured him I had no idea about his bad deputy. But he ended up inviting me to come talk at a Rotary breakfast. And so after the Rotary breakfast, I spoke at the breakfast, and then he wanted to give me a tour, Bill and me both, a tour of his office and the jail. So we're wandering through the jail, and they're explaining to me how they no longer have sworn officers minding the gates because they had a situation where there was a disturbance inside the jail. And both sworn officers went into the jail. One of them had a heart attack and died, and nobody else could get inside. So he's in the middle of telling us this story, and I think we were in the library, and a voice comes over the intercom. Sheriff Logan, Sheriff Logan. He says, yes. Did you remember you have a meeting at the county executive's office? And he took off and said, I'll send somebody to get you. But that's actually the only jail I've ever been in.
Well, I thought you did a good job. Years and years ago, I had some friends that lived in Sacramento, and for a treat, they took me to Folsom Prison. And not only to Folsom Prison, but we got to tour the execution chamber, which, and I don't remember, once again, Patrick, your moment. There's a movie by Susan Hayward, a very powerful movie in which Susan Hayward is the serial killer convicted and serving time. I'm pretty sure it's in Folsom and is executed there. But I can still remember how awful it felt to be inside the prison, but at least I had the luxury of knowing I could walk out.
Yes. And of course, Mateo is sort of convinced that he should take this prison. He didn't do the crime. But the lawyers, his public defender said, well, you're better off taking a plea deal than risking a first degree murder conviction. So even though he was not guilty of that murder, he was convicted of that murder and spent 16 years of his life just for nothing. And of course, his connection to Allie Reynolds is that before he was involved in that homicide, he was working for B. Simpson's previous company. And he remembers Stu Ramey from that time. And that's how he gets drawn back into the story.
So from Patrick, the name of the Susan Hayward, I just love this. It's like having my own version of Wikipedia online. It's called I Want to Live, a very powerful movie.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very old movie, but in any case, if you want to see the inside of a prison, really experience it, you can watch I Want to Live. So we have Mateo, whose only sin was that he was very much in love with a young woman, and they're at a party, and they have kind of a spat. And she goes off and disappears. And when she's found dead, Mateo seems like the obvious suspect.
He's the boyfriend.
And he doesn't really have, I mean, he isn't guilty, but there's nothing to really show that he didn't do it. And there's a pretty cursory investigation and a public defender who, you know, is not being paid to work very hard, does advise him to take a plea deal rather than risk a more serious offense. But the thing is, while he's inside, this is where Judy gets to resurrect her early career, right? Because there's a woman inside who really helps him.
Yes. He is befriended by the librarian, who is a total neophyte when it comes to technology. And he happens to be in the library when her computer system collapses and she can't understand the tech who's trying to tell her what to do. And so he brings the computer system back to life. He reinstates it and he becomes the librarian's right-hand man. And she helps him keep pace with the changes in technology that are happening outside the prison. She helps him when he's about to be released. She helps him locate a place to live. So she's really a good friend to him. But the warden in that story is an interesting character too. You only see him briefly.
Right.
And when Mateo is escorted to his office on the day he's supposed to be leaving, he thinks it's going to be some kind of bad news, but the warden is really wishing him well. And I thought that was an interesting take on someone who is usually portrayed as a hard-ass jerk.
I thought it was too. I mean, I thought that the people in the prison, the librarian and the warden, treated him very well. And also he gets a very nice little surprise from this is his grandmother, I think it is. Anyway, the question is, you know, what is Mateo's life going to be? He's been in there for 16 years. He's managed to keep his, well, it's been like, he's almost had like a long graduate course in, you know, tech and computer science. But his one goal, Judy, is what?
Pardon?
His one goal when he gets out of prison, what is it that he most wants to do?
What he most wants to do is to find out who really killed his girlfriend.
Right.
And as his prison cellmate says, UNOJ, what do you think that's going to get you? But that is his goal. But once he makes contact, He accidentally comes in contact with B. Simpson and Stu Ramey, and they can see that he has some potential, and they offer him the possibility of coming to work for High Noon Enterprises. And then an interesting thing happened to me as the writer, because I could see that in order to find out who really killed that girl, a cold case had to be investigated. And I just happened to have a terrific cold case investigator in Seattle, a guy named J.P. Beaumont. Now, there's a small problem with that. The Allie Reynolds books belong to Simon & Schuster, and the Beaumont books belong to HarperCollins. In the publishing world, it's sort of like the Capulets and the Montagues of Romeo and Juliet fame. So I stand with a foot in both worlds. So I was able to negotiate a peace treaty with my HarperCollins editor to allow J.P. Beaumont to appear as a character in this book. The Beaumont books, from the very beginning, from that first scene in Until Proven Guilty, when he's walking around on Magnolia Bluff, examining a crime scene. When I wrote that scene, I was on a train between Seattle and Portland, and I thought, well, what would happen if I wrote this book through the detective's point of view? So I wrote that scene. And there he was, and I saw it. So I was walking around in his shoes. I heard what he was hearing. I heard what he was saying. But I also heard what was going on in his head. So the Beaumont books, from that scene on, have been written through J.P. Beaumont's first-person point of view. The Allie Reynolds books are written in the third person. The Joanna Brady books are written in the third person. And the truth of the matter is, third person is a lot easier to write. So as I'm getting closer to the point where J.P. Beaumont is going to be involved in this book, I'm still thinking, well, it's okay. He'll be in the third person when he gets here too. Except it just didn't work that way. When it came time for that scene, there was J.P. Beaumont in all his 70-something curmudgeonly first-person glory, and he wouldn't have it any other way. So that's how I wrote it. That's how I sent it to New York. I had a brand new editor. She was a one book editor. She was there for that editor and gone for the next one, but you know, that's publishing. But she had never read a Beaumont book. So Beaumont was a complete mystery to her. And when the third person narrative stopped and the J.P. Beaumont first person started, she went straight up, she turned left and she said, no, this won't work. So she went through every portion of the book that had J.P. Beaumont in it and changed his parts from first person to third person. And she told me she had done it. And I thought, well, I'm really too close to this. Maybe if somebody else does it, it'll be okay. Then she sent me the manuscript. And it was shocking because the first moment J.P. Beaumont became he or him, he instantly stop being this living, breathing creature and was suddenly a paper doll cardboard cutout. So I wrote back to the editor and I said, I'm sorry. My way or the highway, either J.P. Beaumont is in the first person in this book or this book doesn't exist. So J.P. Beaumont is in this book, first person. So I don't know how people who have never read a Beaumont book are going to feel when this guy suddenly shows up in the middle of the Allie Reynolds stories. But I did have a reaction from someone who had never read one before. And she said, well, within just a couple of minutes, I was in the story with him. And so I think it'll be okay. But long-term readers who miss Bo a lot, I think, will be happy to find him in this book.
Sure, they will. Yeah, readers are fairly flexible. And I was telling Judy when we were emailing about this book that years ago, we hosted a conference here in Scottsdale. It was 1996, actually, and a variety of authors like Michael Connelly came and talked about Raymond Chandler and Val McDermott about Joe Gorse and various other, Laurie King about Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. And an author, one of the authors, wrote a paper about Robert Louis Stevenson, from which I learned, and I read Treasure Island, but really didn't pay any attention to it, that Stevenson got stuck when writing Treasure Island, and he had the same problem that Judy is talking about. He was writing it in third, I hope I have this right, it may be the other way around, but I think I'm right. He's writing it in third person with, you know, all the pirates and everything. And then it just didn't work when he needed to tell the story from the point of view of the boy. And so eventually he figured out that he would just tell it in first person. So Treasure Island is exactly the way Judy is talking about. You've got, you know, third person, which allows you to explore many characters at the same time, kind of observing it. And then you have the kid telling his own story in his own voice.
Well,
and it all works.
And in this book, it was really helpful to have third person because you can see Mateo dealing with his issues of finding his way back into society. You can see a really scary character named Broomy, who is a serial killer sort of lurking in the background. And by the time he shows up in Sedona, the readers all know who he is, but none of the people in Sedona understand how dangerous he is. And then there's the other aspect of this story, which is what is going on in the background of Allie Reynolds' family. So I'm juggling three different balls in this book, and it was a fun book to write.
Well, it's a wonderful book to read, and I come back to my original point, which is that this is not a whodunit. This is about, you know, what's going to happen. Because you know Mateo, you know what his background is, and you know he comes out of prison, and thanks to the library, and he has enough skills that he can get hired at High Noon and pursue his goal, if he can, of finding out who killed his girlfriend. And then you have McCluskey, the serial killer, who has a fix on another employee of High Noon, and you get his whole backstory, which again, you have to tell in third person. By the way, I wanted to tell you, you have to read the book to find out why I say this. I just love the border guard. The border guard on the Mexican side was like the best character ever. He only had about, what, one paragraph in the book, but he's just terrific. I laughed so hard when I got to him. Good for you.
And it's such a small part of the story.
Yep.
But yet that family with the one brother guarding one side of the U.S.-Mexican border and the other brother on the other side.
Yep. And
the bad guy is trying to get through between them. He doesn't stand a chance.
Yeah, it's really good. And, you know, you have a real gift for bringing a character to life in just a few sentences. I mean, that's all he gets, you know, but he's terrific. That's all we're going to say about him because
I started writing the next Beaumont book. And there is a character in there that I found absolutely enchanting. And she was cursed by her father with the name Twinkle Winkleman. and she goes by Twink. And she is a character She is a character in her own right, and I enjoyed writing every single Twinkle Winkleman scene.
That's a great. Do you know about the Texan, a man named Hogg, Mr. Hogg?
No.
All right. He was some kind of rich Texan, and he had two daughters. His last name is Hogg, and he named one of them Ima and the other one Yura. No. Isn't that incredibly cool?
I've never heard that story.
That was a true story. And I've always thought, what a real sadist he must have been to do that to his daughters. Lord. The other element.
Name was Sue.
Sorry?
Shades of the boy whose name was Sue.
Yeah, well, I think I'm and You're a Hog probably are the worst of all of those. I can't imagine they didn't do a name change as soon as they got old enough to manage it. Lord. But the other book, these are serious questions. I'm laughing, but the whole.
Oops.
But he's tenacious enough and intelligent enough and makes friends well enough to survive what happens to him and embark upon a new life. And McCluskey, the serial killer, you really do kind of get into his head, even though he's repulsive and you hope he isn't going to get away with it. But I think the most moving part of the book really is Allie's parents. And, you know, as we're all aging, the question of what do we do with someone who's developing dementia and what do we do as a caregiver if that person is a really sensitive subject. Now, I knew your parents, Judy, because we did a number of events with for them over in Apache Junction when they were still alive together. And they had a really long marriage, didn't they?
68 years. It was always incredibly difficult to be at a book signing event as both the writer and the daughter.
Right.
Because Abby had a way of taking over the scene if she possibly could. But my parents had a very long marriage. When they moved to Apache Junction, they still had their car keys and they still had the Buick. And they never saw the movie Thelma and Louise, but they had discussed doing a Thelma and Louise exit. And then my dad pulled a dirty trick on my mother and had a stroke and died. And my mother spent the next 5 years mad as hell. And I don't think it may have been a form of dementia, but what happened to my mother is she completely lost her sense of humor. She became really sort of bitingly sarcastic and sort of mean. And when she stayed with us for a few weeks in Tucson, I'd be coming down the hall and she'd make a remark as I went past, and I'd be in tears by the time I got to the family room. And so when I wrote a book called Damage Control, when I found she lived like that for 5 years, and her position was Norman had no business going off and leaving her alone like that. That was, so when I heard that she was dead, my sister called me. I was on a book tour in Portland. I didn't cry when Janie told me. We went to Bisbee for the funeral. I didn't cry at the funeral because she kept telling me she wanted to be with her dad, my dad, and that's where she was. But my folks always like to do forenoon coffee, and they like to do forenoon coffee picnics. And they would take their little red checked oilcloth tablecloth to picnic tables here and there all over southern Arizona. And they had these two melamine cups that they had rescued from the cafeteria garage sale. And they had a Scotsman plaid thermos. And so my mother would pour coffee out of the thermos into the cups, and then she'd whip her paring knife. She always had a paring knife in her purse, out of her purse, and cut this usually day old sweet roll in half, and they would have their picnic. Well, in Damage Control, there's a little couple who has their forenoon picnic on a table with a red and check violet oilcloth tablecloth. And when the picnic is over, they pack everything up, they get in the car, they do not fasten their seatbelts, and the husband hits the gas pedal, takes it all the way to the floor, and they go screaming off the mountain in together.
Yeah.
I didn't cry at the funeral. I didn't cry when I heard. But I shed buckets of tears while I was writing that scene. because it was my way of honoring my parents and my writer's way of grieving for them.
I remember that scene. I remember reading it and thinking, you know, there's an old Greek myth. I can't remember the names of the old couple, but they...
Joseph and Philemon.
Thank you. That's exactly
Philemon stared into the hearth, and the hearth stared listlessly back at one whose fire was all but ash. His hands hung down like dry leaves, motionless in the summer's aftermath. So laborers sit at the end of a day or a lifetime.
Well, if it's the same characters, which I think it is, they offer hospitality to one of the gods, and he grants them their wish, which is to turn into trees and grow together and twine together outside the door of their home.
I have that poem in my computer, and I will send you a copy of it. It's by C. Day Lewis. It's C. Day Lewis's version of that myth. And our garden outside is full of big rocks that have little pieces of that poem carved into it. Their cottage in the comb below was changed, cobwebs to pearl, thatch to gold. The seed hears not the harvest anthem, but our whole garden here in Bellevue, Washington, is devoted to that. And actually, there was a thing done in the Pacific Magazine, an article about that. And if you want, I can send you the link.
Please do. I would love to. I've always thought that was one of the most beautiful of all the Greek myths, because many of them are not beautiful. Many of them bad, really bad things happen and so forth to illustrate the capriciousness of the gods and all. But I always loved that one because I thought it was such a great story.
You see those two trees on the hillside over the lake, a lime tree and an oak with a stone circle around them? A strange thing, you say, to see two trees wearing a wedding ring. You would not if you knew their story.
That's lovely. Please do send that to me. I would like to see it. When I was in fifth grade, I'd read my way through the entire Crow Island School Library. And the only thing I hadn't read was Bullfinch's Age of Fable, which is, you know, this enormous block of a book. So they let me have it, even though it was not considered suitable reading for the fifth grade, because there's a lot of bad stuff that goes on in Greek mythology. But anyway, I did read it. And, you know, that has really informed my whole reading life, because so much comes from those Greek myths. You know, so much of Western civilization, so much of the stories that we know, really arise from classical Greek and the myths.
But I think in terms of unfinished business, I think a lot of people are going to see events occurring in their families reflected in this.
I do too.
In a way that maybe having your family disrupted by a homicide is not. I think what's going on with Ellie's family is a lot more universal.
I think it is too. And I think this book is remarkable in that you have all three stories flow along, and they each carry their own weight, and they each reach a conclusion, but they don't get mixed up, and coincidence doesn't feel as though it's a major player in this, which sometimes when you try to write something like this, it does feel artificial, but in this case, it really is very seamless. I read it all in one swoop, Judy, because you know how fast I read. So, you know, I went right through it in a couple of hours, and it was really powerful. And honestly, I did cry in a place or two. I thought it's an amazing story, you know.
I received an email this week from someone who said she was sending me a bread and butter note because she felt as though reading my books gave her a chance to visit the homes of all the people who were characters in my book. And I was so touched by that because it felt as though she regards my characters as people rather than superheroes.
Well, I think that's a good point. In this book, I mean, you know, not many of us are actually sheriffs. or policeman or whatever. But, you know, in the alley, in this particular Allie Reynolds book, I mean, you know, you can imagine these are people that you could encounter. These are people that, except for the serial killer, these are people you could actually be.
And well, if you knew he was a serial killer, you wouldn't be trying to evict him.
Good point. Anyway, I think it's very well done. And, you know, I'm so glad that you give Northern Arizona a chance to shine as a landscape. You know, I mean, Tony did a wonderful job with the Navajo Reservation, although most of it's in New Mexico. But, you know, we don't see much written about Northern Arizona that's not reservation land. It's not Hopi or it's not Navajo. And so I really like, and we drove through Sedona recently, and I remember it, you know, as this little tiny, you know, place. And now it's just so overgrown. I mean, it's not the way it was when I first went there. A few cabins down in Oak Creek and, you know, a couple little coffee places and so forth. And it's changed dramatically. But the great news is that the beautiful rocks, the actual geology is still there.
Missing and Endangered gave me a chance to show off Flagstaff and Northern Arizona State University, because people from the other side of the Mississippi, a lot of them think that Arizona is one big forest of saguaros and that's it. Right. And they have no concept of the difference in terrain, in geography, in botany, the ecologies, the buried ecologies of all those different landscapes, yeah. I find fascinating. And that's part of what I love about Arizona.
Well, it is too. And Jerome, you know, you those of you who read the Joanna Brady's know that Bisbee is an old mining town, you know, the Copper Queen, the rest of it. But Jerome, which is right up west of Sedona, was an old mining town too. And like many of these old mining towns, it's been kind of reimagined as an art center. Lots of artists and, you know, touristy kind. It's like Madrid outside of Santa Fe, where they actually have a melodrama, the Madrid melodrama, which I have been to see. And these kinds of towns do tend to attract people who are interested in the arts. So down at Tubac, for example, all the way down south, almost on the Mexican border, has an arts festival every year. And so, you know, they're wonderful to visit. And this is part of our history. The West, in fact, was so much of it was extraction. You know, it was exploited for extraction of minerals and so forth, and had all these little grasslands.
The Arizona grasslands were devoured by overgrazing and changed forever. One of my favorite Jerome stories is Jerome was built in canyons with frame houses and frame buildings, which were very susceptible to fire. And so a fire was burning and it was coming straight toward the local whorehouse. And the madam went to the fire brigade and said, if you will save my business, everybody on the brigade gets a free pass. Well, they did, and then the mines played out, and that was the end of the business.
I love it. Well, there are a lot of great stories to be told here, but it's wonderful. I mean, J.P. Beaumont is really, you know, a wonderful tour of Seattle. When I first met you, you were still writing. You hadn't started writing the Arizona books yet, and so people got to know Seattle through Beaumont. But as you've been writing these, the Diana Walker books, or, you know, Tucson and that area, and then Joanna and Bisbee and all around it, and now Allie up in Northern Arizona. I think I'm always puzzled why Arizona doesn't have more writers, because there's so much here to, you know, to write about. Why are they all in Boston, for example, or Minneapolis? I've never quite figured that out.
But, right, me either.
No, but anyway, let's call Patrick up. It's time to summon you, Patrick. You're an Arizonan. You're an actual Arizona historian. What do you want to dive in and say?
I don't know. You put me on the spot there. I think there are more. I think there are more Arizona writers coming up all the time, actually.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You've got a lot of people watching, Judy, and making some really nice comments as always. Let's see if I have any actual questions. Well, somebody is asking, Barbara, how many books a week do you read? You must read fast.
I read very fast. I read 3 or 4 books a day, and on a good week, I might read 20. I will say that I don't necessarily read every word of every book. If I get into it and I find that it's not really rewarding me, because I'm looking across the room at probably 400 advanced reading copies, and I need to get through them. So I might skip to the end. And so Judy knows when I say I read this whole book, that means I really loved it, because I didn't have to read it all. But I was so absorbed in it that I did. So it's kind of getting to the point where to read an entire book means I really loved it.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I mean, it was a wonderful couple of hours that, you know, just took me right away. I was fascinated with it.
One thing that people often, a question people often ask me is, do I outline? And my problem with outlining is if I knew how a book was going to end, I would have no reason to write it. I hit a point in this most recent Beaumont book where I was at 80% and still didn't know how it was going to end. Of course, I figured it out, but for me, outlining just doesn't work. I know there are writers who do outlining, but I'm just not one of them.
Well, in this book where you have 3 separate story arcs, I think you could probably see your way forward for at least one of them, probably from the beginning, but the other two maybe not.
Nope, I found it all out as I went along.
I thought maybe you knew one of them for sure, but in any case, they all work, so good job. Anything else there, Patrick?
Yeah, I have a couple of people that are asking. They're curious about the story, Judy, of your husband picking up the serial killer. And I know you've told that before. Can you elaborate at all?
It was the 20th of May of 1970. Not the 20th, the 22nd of May of 1970, a Friday afternoon. I had to stay late after school to decorate for the prom. We lived 30 miles. We taught at Sells. We lived at Three Points, which was 30 miles west of Sells. And Tucson was 30 miles west of Three Points. And we were expecting company at our house. It was a house on a little volcanic knoll. We called it the house on the hill. And we were expecting company that evening. And someone had to be at home to let the company in. So when the principal said I would decorate for the prom that afternoon instead of on Saturday, which the kids and I had already planned, my husband said, well, when school gets out, I'll hitchhike home. And then when you get done, you can drive home and we'll go into Tucson for dinner. So as I was leaving school around 5, I looked over at Law and Order as I was leaving, and there were all kinds of strange cop cars there. And I thought, well, all the cops are here. I can drive home as fast as I want. And so I did. I got home in a hell of a hurry. I got to the house. We loaded up, started into town to dinner, and we had just turned. Our house was 2 miles off the highway, the Highway 86. So just after we turned on Highway 86 to go into Tucson, there was a roadblock, and we stopped and we said, what's going on? And the deputy said, there's been a homicide on the reservation. We said, Indian or Anglo? He said, Anglo. We said, good, nobody we know then. So we went on to the trading post, and while my husband was pumping gas, I went in to pay the bill, and I overheard a deputy talking to the clerk and saying something about a man in a green car and something about 2 little kids. So when I got back into the car, I reported that conversation to my husband, And a couple miles down the road, he said, I had a green car. I wonder if that's the guy who gave me a ride home this afternoon. So we went back to the trading post. We told them who we were, where we lived, that we didn't have a telephone, and that my husband had ridden home from school that day with a man in a green car. We got home that night after dinner. The next morning at 6 o'clock, Jack Lyons, who was Pima County's chief homicide cop, was at our door. And he told us that the previous afternoon, some miners coming home from working at the Hecla mine over by Casa Grande had seen these two little Anglo kids, a four-year-old boy and a two-year-old girl, walking along the highway. Now, this is the end of May, in the middle of the desert, the middle of the afternoon. It's hot. So the Indian stopped and said to the kids, what are you doing? And the little boy said, we're walking on the beach. And the Indian said, where's your mommy? And the boy said, she's over there, she's dead. Well, she wasn't dead when they got there, but she died before they ever got her to the hospital. She had been taking her kids to Rocky Point for the weekend, 10 miles west of Sells. She was forced off the highway at gunpoint, shot, raped in front of her two small children, and left to die. So Jack told us what had happened. And from 6 o'clock in the morning until 3:30 in the afternoon, he interviewed my husband. He got my husband to remember all kinds of telling details about items in the car, about stuff the guy said, all of these bits and pieces that helped Jack Lyons identify who the killer was. Jack, based on things my husband told him, and well, okay, that was Saturday. On Sunday, we went to town and went to car dealerships until my husband could say that he had been given a ride in a green Maverick. The next day we went to town and he did a composite sketch of the guy who gave him a ride home. And the four-year-old boy looked at it and said, that's the man who killed my mommy. Within days, Jack used information my husband gave him to identify who the killer was. But he didn't exactly tell us because he figured out he was dealing with a serial killer, someone who killed people at 20 minutes after 2 on the 22nd day of the month. And he shot them off moving vehicles. He shot a 16-year-old girl off a bicycle, a 40-something-year-old man off a bulldozer, and this 28-year-old woman taking her kids to Mexico. Jack didn't want to arrest the guy until he had all of his ducks in a row. He did suggest that maybe we should go live someplace else for a while, but we were young and stupid, we didn't. We stayed on the hill. I was on the hill for probably 40 of the next 60 days. I wore a loaded weapon. I was fully prepared to use it. I actually did fire it one day. I fired all 6 shots at a rapidly retreating rattlesnake. Didn't come close to hitting him. He was still laughing when he went over the wall and disappeared. But Jack was concerned that the incidents were moving closer together. And so on the 20th of July, he took my husband to San Manuel, where my husband identified the killer as he came off shift. My husband rode back to Tucson with Jack Lyons with the killer in the back seat. And while he was in the back seat, he admitted to having been at our house on 3 separate occasions in the intervening 60 days. The first book I ever wrote was a book called By Reason of Insanity. It was never published. For one thing, it was 1,400 pages long. But in the course of writing that, it was a very thinly fictionalized version of that real story. In the course of writing 1,400 pages, I wrote the equivalent of 3 complete novels. And that was my on-the-job training as a writer. Eventually, when I tired of Beaumont and was thinking about knocking him off after book 9, my editor said, well, you remember that book nobody ever bought? How about if you rework that one? And I didn't want to write that the killer was still in prison in Florence, Arizona. He still is in prison in Florence, Arizona. And I didn't want him to come looking for me. So I took what I learned in the course of standing on the sidelines for that investigation and used that to tell the story in Hour of the Hunter, the first Walker family book. In 2001, I was in Payson, Arizona, doing a library event, and there was a woman standing at the back of the room. She stood there. She didn't smile. She didn't laugh at any of the jokes. She just stood there with both hands folded across her chest. And most every book signing has somebody who's a bit of a problem. Like the guy who came to a signing and said, are you the lady who writes the murder mysteries? I said, yes. He said, I've just been acquitted of murdering 7 people. Do you want to write my book? I said, thank you. So I figured the lady at the back of the room was going to be the problem child at this signing. Sure enough, she waited until the end of the line. The troublemakers always do. And when she came up to the table, she said, was your husband a witness in a series of homicides that occurred in Tucson in 1970? And I said, yes, he was. And with no further introduction, as though we had been having information, as though we'd been having this conversation for 30 years, she said, my father was the man on the bulldozer. My mother was pregnant with me when that happened. She would never talk to me about it. What can you tell me? And that is an excellent reason to never include real homicides in books, because real homicides affect real people. And it's just not okay to use someone else's life to create something in fiction.
Wow, what a story. To change tracks, people are asking about the beautiful painting behind you.
Oh,
that tell us about that.
That's done. It's Tuscany, done by M.L. Coleman, who is a painter from Sedona. I don't know. Can you see? I had little pieces of Michael Coleman, Arizona, all over the house. It's how I keep from losing my Arizona touch by having ML Coleman's with me. But he's a very talented landscape artist, and I'm fortunate to be able to count him as a friend.
Nice. A question, let's see. Somebody's asking about, you know, your poetry, you know, your early poetry. Have you continued to write poetry ever since?
Writing that poetry was an outlet for me during a really difficult time in my life. It was a time when I was newly married. I was seeing that my husband's drinking, which he said wasn't a problem, really was a problem. And I was struggling with staying in the marriage or leaving the marriage, living with someone who was clearly in over his head, and nothing I could do could help him. Of course, I finally figured out that you can't fix someone who doesn't want to be fixed. But that was at a time in my life when he had told me there was only going to be one writer in our family, and he was it. So I wrote the poetry under the dark of night when he was passed out cold, and he never saw it because he didn't want me to be a writer. The poetry in After the Fire is entirely personal. Anyone who has ever been involved with someone with an addiction understands everything about that book. Once I started writing mysteries, mysteries gave me all kinds of freedom. Writing mysteries gave me all kinds of freedom to deal with whatever issues I wanted to. You know, and something happened to me just a couple of days ago. I was being interviewed about unfinished business, and someone said something about Brumi's mother. Brumi's mother, Brumi is the serial killer, and the first victim he kills is his mother. And whoever was interviewing me asked me something about her. And suddenly I realized where she came from. I used my paternal grandmother, who was and still is the meanest woman I ever met, as a pattern for Brumi's mother. But it was invisible to me at the time I was writing it. It took an outsider asking me a question about that long after the book was written before I saw where that character had come from.
So inevitably you end up mining your own life, if not other people's, in order to, you know, in order to have something to say.
I think writers are the great recyclers. Everything that happens to you along the way in living is grist for the mill, and I use it all. I've been blessed with a lot of lemons in my life, and I've turned them all into lemonade.
Well, you know, you're a survivor, Judy, and you know, you've had a lot to overcome, but you are, and I'm sure writing in its way is, I don't want to say it's a form of therapy, but it's a way of coping, I think, with all the things that happen.
Well, in writing the Joanna Brady books, in seeing what's going on in Joanna's life, I've learned to understand my mother's point of view, and I've learned to understand my daughter's point of view. And so it is sort of a form of self-therapy, of putting yourself in someone else's circumstances and figuring out how they would handle a particular issue.
And if you are a really devoted reader, you can take other people's stories and apply them to your own life and achieve something of the same result. I have learned much about myself and people in my life by reading books.
I've heard from a number of people who said that watching J.P. Beaumont struggle with drinking in his early books helped them with their own issues with drinking. It was sort of as though they could see what was happening to Beau in a way that their relatives couldn't point out what was happening to them. It was sort of a sideways around their denial. But when I hear people tell me about how that helped them, and when I hear from people who tell me what an important book After the Fire has been for them when they've been coming through tough times, those stories always really bring me a lot of joy.
Well, living a long time is its own revenge on lemons. So, well, it is, you know, it's interesting. I've lost a couple of people in my life in the last month, and you know, younger than I am, and you know, it's been hard, and you wonder why it is that you're still here and they aren't, and you look back over their lives and your interactions with them and wish you could have done better, or but you learn even more about yourself. You know, living to be old is a blessing in lots of ways, because it does help you understand much of what might not have been so easily viewed when you were younger.
A real blessing in my life, a part of being, having survived this long, came about when in second grade, my second grade teacher was Lucy Spangler, And she had books in her classroom that students could select from the shelves under the window and tape back to their desks to read if they finished their work early. And of course I did. And so the books I chose to read from Mrs. Spangler's books were Frank Baum's Oz books, not just The Wizard of Oz, but the whole
all of them.
Collection of Oz books. And what I took away from the Oz books wasn't so much the wizard. I didn't come out wanting the Wizard of Oz, wanting to be the wizard or Dorothy. What I wanted to do was be Frank Baum, putting the words on the pages. And that's, I've been lucky and blessed in that I'm able to live that dream. But a number of years ago, in the build up to the Tucson Festival of Books, CBS affiliate sent a camera crew to our home in Tucson to do an interview. And the cameraman turned out to be Lucy Spangler's grandson, who inherited all her books. And I was able to tell Lucy Spangler's grandson what a huge impact having his grandmother as my second grade teacher made on the entire arc of my life.
What a wonderful story. You know what? Next time we do this, we're going to just do Oz books, because that was my treat for my birthday and Christmas every year from 4 years old on up till they stopped was the Oz books. And I lived in that magical kingdom. It was the biggest influence, I think, on me as a child. I just loved it. I loved the adventures, the whole thing. So we can talk Oz. But meantime, we've probably talked enough tonight, wearing out our audience. So let me say thank you, Judy, for another wonderful evening. And let me say to still have a few autographed copies of Unfinished Business, which is really a wonderful book that works on many levels. So if you say, I never read, it doesn't matter, because this is a book with universal stories in it. So thank you, Judy, for a really wonderful reading experience. And it's been a great pleasure to talk to you again tonight.
Thank you. And now I'll go dip into some non-Sedona scotch.
Great. And we'll talk about J.P. Beaumont next time around.
Okay.
Indeed we will. All right, Patrick, thanks as always for your help. Good night, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.